Let's go ahead and continue our story in 1 Samuel chapter number 7 at verse number 5, where it says there, Samuel said, "Gather all Israel at Mizpah, and I will pray to he who is for you." So they gathered at Mizpah and drew water and poured it out before he who is and fasted on that day and said there, "We have sinned against he who is." And Samuel judged the people of Israel at Mizpah. So this is happening probably in the seventh month of 1056 BC, the seventh Jewish month, which would make it right around the beginning of the fall. The reason I think it's the seventh month is because there is a later association of pouring out water during the tabernacle festival. This was an attachment to the story of the water from the rock during the Exodus, and then eventually it attaches itself to prophecies about there being a miraculous fountain future that will flow out from the Temple Mount. It's referenced, at least hinted at, in the story of the Feast of Tabernacles, Jesus' final Feast of Tabernacles in John's Gospel. So the Ark was returned sometime in the third, fourth, or fifth Jewish month, and then this gathering of repentance, national repentance and confession, takes place probably a couple of months after that. And Samuel is the one that's leading in it. He calls the people to destroy their idols of Baal and Asherah and to only worship God. And then he becomes the singular judge of the people of Israel. Now, verse 7 reports that when the Philistines heard that the people of Israel had gathered at Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. So the Philistines hear that there's this national assembly, not terribly far from their border with Israel. Now this is at Mizpah, which is about a mile south of Gibeon. And so that puts it roughly, let's see here, let me check my mileage using my tools here. That puts it roughly 15 air miles at the most from the border with the Philistine territories. The Philistines had destroyed the Israeli sacred city of Shiloh the previous year. And so the Philistines are probably assuming that the Israelis want revenge and that that's why they're gathering together. So they decide to attack first. Now the rest of verse 7 says, when the people of Israel heard of it, they were afraid of the Philistines because they got their clocks cleaned the previous year. Verse 8, the people of Israel said to Samuel, "Do not cease to cry out to he who is our God for us, that he may save us from the hands of the Philistines." So they see Samuel, who is right around his 40th birthday, more than likely. They see him as the only possible one that can lead in the salvation of their nation against the Philistine threat. So they beg him to act as the judge of Israel, the military judge. Verse 9, so Samuel took a nursing lamb and offered it as a whole burnt offering to he who is. And Samuel cried out to he who is for Israel, and he who is answered him. As Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to attack Israel. But he who is thundered with a mighty sound that day against the Philistines and threw them into confusion, and they were routed before Israel. And the men of Israel went out from Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and struck them as far as below Beth-gar. So the Philistine army of the five lords of the Philistine, they were advancing on the city of Mizpah. And the route that they would have taken probably would have gone past Beth-horon. And once Samuel begs God through a sacrifice to save them, God does so miraculously. He causes this great big noise of thunder and lightning to scare the Philistines that they were being attacked by God. And remember, they've just suffered under God's hands earlier in the year and the year previous. So they are quick to retreat once this supernatural sound and sight occurs. And the Israelis jump on top of that. They chase them right down to the plains of the Mediterranean, killing them as they go. Verse 12 says, "Then Samuel took a stone, and he set it up between Mizpah and Shin." We don't know exactly where this location is. It's probably somewhere along that route of the Philistine retreat and the Israeli defeat of the Philistines. Perhaps down close again to where the hill country flattens out into the Mediterranean plain area. And so he sets up a memorial stone, and he called its name Ebenezer, which in Hebrew means stone of help. Now, this is not to be confused with another place called Ebenezer, which was up by Aphek, quite a few miles to the north, which was the last place that the Philistines got a victory against the Israelis on their way to destroy Shiloh. So there may be some connectiveness here between the names, that they were defeated near Ebenezer in the north, but here God gave them the victory, so they give a new name of Ebenezer down here in the south, because this is where the Lord has helped us. This is where he who is has been our help. Verse number 13. "So the Philistines were subdued and did not again enter the territory of Israel. And the hand of he who is was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel." So the Philistines are now going to be under control until the time of Samuel shifts over to the time of Saul. Because by then, Samuel will be an older man. He'll be about my age, about 60. And he will not be the strong physical presence that he is right now, where he is the victor, the victorious leader against the Philistines on this day. So they're going to have peace on the border with the Philistines for the next 20 years. Now, verse 14 reports, "The cities that the Philistines had taken from Israel," meaning from the time immediately after the death of Samson until this victory here. So cities right there on the border between Beth Shemesh and Gath and Ekron. "The cities that the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel from Ekron to Gath, and Israel delivered their territory from the hand of the Philistines. And there was peace also between Israel and the Amorites." So the Philistines are going to be kept away from the western borders invasions, at least for about 20 years. And on the east side of the Jordan, the border between the eastern annexed territories of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, that border with the Ammonites will also be secure because we have a strong judge that is in leadership. And Israel, because of that strong leadership, is mostly behaving itself and worshiping the one true God. There will clearly be some people that are worshiping the other gods and goddesses on the sly, but it's not out in the open right now. And so, verse number 15 says, Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, and he went on a circuit year by year to Bethel, Gilgal, and Mizpah. And he judged Israel in all these places. Then he would return to Ramah, for his home was there. And there also he judged Israel, and he built there an altar to He Who Is. Now, when we get a map out, and I'm using my own little additions to Google Earth, because I like to see the terrain around the map when I'm doing my map work. These cities that we're talking about are in the central region of Israel's promised land, in the area immediately north of where modern-day Israel is located. Most of these places are actually in the Palestinian territories right now, which is terribly unfortunate because it makes it impossible really to get in there and do any type of decent tourism if you're over trying to look at the Bible lands right now. But the places that are mentioned here would be Bethel, which is in the north. The next city that's mentioned is Gilgal, which is a few miles to the southwest of Bethel. And then Mizpah, which is a few miles southwest of Gilgal and immediately south, about a mile of Gibeon, where the tabernacle is going to be reconstructed. And then Ramah, which is the hometown of the prophet Samuel, is where the modern day of Ramallah is located. And that's just a few miles north and east of where Mizpah was located. And then the circuit would continue by Samuel going north along the main highway until he came to Bethel again. So we're talking about a circuit that's less than, I believe, 10 miles in total, maybe a dozen miles in total. So he sticks right here in the center of Israel's held territory. Now, a lot of people get confused because Gilgal is the prominent name of the place down in the Jordan Valley where Israel first entered into the land. But during this time period, the more prominent Gilgal is the one in the territory of Benjamin that I just mentioned a few moments ago. All right, so the next 20 years, so that's talking about 1056 to 1038 BC, thereabouts, 1037, to have a full 20 years. That's where Samuel is Israel's hero. He is Israel's spiritual leader, and he is Israel's military protector. His strong personality keeps the enemies at bay on both the Philistine border and the Ammonite border. But then something happens after 20 years. Samuel gets older. It says in chapter 8, verse 1, when Samuel became old. Now, I don't think he's ancient because by my estimation, he's right around 60, which is how old I am right now, and I don't consider myself ancient. So when Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. So if he's 60, then probably his sons are in their 30s. And he puts them into positions of leadership outside of that little circuit area that we've been talking about for himself. Verse 2 says, the name of his firstborn was Yoel, and the name of his second, Abiya. And they were judges in Beersheba. Now, elsewhere, the indication seems to be that one of them was a judge down in Beersheba, which is down in the south. And the other one was a judge up in the Galilee region in the north. And that makes good geographical sense, that he would take control of the area in the heartland and provide judgeship there, while his sons went south and north and provided judgeship there. Now, unfortunately, the sons are not like the father. Now, they're not like Hophni and Phinehas. They're not like the bad guys that Eli raised, but they are still not as righteous as their father. Because verse number 3 reports, yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. So when they heard cases, they didn't treat them blindly according to God's law like they should have. They instead allowed their decisions to be influenced by the wealth or authority or personality of those who were involved in the case. And this is where we can infer that as Samuel gets older, his personality starts waning in its control over the people of Israel. And as we've seen before in the cycle, as the judge loses his strength, the people's sins start bubbling up to the surface and start causing troubles, and that's where God's judgment begins to come to the forefront again. And again, we can infer from things that come up later that the Philistines on the west start pushing inward into Israeli territory again. And this is how they apparently were doing it. They were controlling trade practices. And they had trade outposts in the interior of Israeli territory. And these trade outposts included security details, so that we actually have Philistines living and trading and operating military personnel inside Israeli territory. And the Israelis are letting it happen. That's coming from the west. In the east, there is a new king over the Ammonites by the name of Nahash. And he is, as we say, saber-rattling. He's even apparently pushing in and encroaching on some of the annexed territories of Gilead. And the Israelis are nervous about that as well. And so that all leads to a meeting between the elders of Israel, the leadership of Israel, and Samuel, their hero judge. And that's reported in verse number 4. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. Now that's his hometown. That's where he kind of finishes his circuit. And they said to him, don't you love it when they start their conversation with you in this fashion? Behold, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. So they've got two complaints. You're not cutting it anymore because you're not the hero, the physical specimen of a man that you were 20 years ago. You're an old guy now. You're 60. And your two boys, they're not like you. They're not doing a good job. So what's their solution that they have in mind? They say, now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations. So what we want, Samuel, is for you to give us a royal dynasty. We want you to designate somebody to be the king of all Israel. And that will start this dynasty of father to son as the king who makes all of the choices of how we live and protects our borders. That's what they're looking for. They want a strong guy. Now, this is, by the way, this is the year 1037 BC, I believe. Probably during the early part of that year, the first half of that year. And Samuel was displeased by this thing when they said, give us a king to judge us. Now, he is upset on a couple of levels, but one of the levels is clearly personal insult that they would tell him that he's not cutting it anymore. That they want him to let somebody else take the reins of leadership. And they don't want his sons because they're not good. So he's upset by this, but he does the right thing. He goes and talks to God about it. So Samuel prayed to He Who Is, and He Who Is said to Samuel, obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. So God sets the record straight with Samuel from the very beginning. He says, look, Samuel, don't take offense at this. It's not about you. It's about me. They don't want me to be their king. So you go ahead and give them the type of king they're looking for. And see, that's where the problem comes with King Saul. Is because he is not the type of king they need. They need a king who has a heart after the heart of God. But they want a strong guy. They want a tall, handsome fighter that looks good in a military parade uniform. That's who they're looking for. And so God says, you give them what they want, but you warn them that this is what's going to happen. Okay, verse number 8, God continues, according to all the deeds that they've done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are also doing to you. Now then, obey their voice, only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. So here is the warning of what it's like to have a human strong man on the throne. So Samuel told all the words of He Who Is to the people who were asking for a king from him. He said, this will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. So he's going to draft your boys into a standing army. The Israelis only had a militia system up to this time of foot soldiers. Here is high-tech stuff mentioned that they were not supposed to be using. So He warns them he's going to make himself a standing army and draft your sons into it. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and equipment of his chariots. See, you cannot have a standing army unless you also have some sort of industrial complex to support that army. So he's going to draft people into that as well. Verse 13, he will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. So he's also going to want to build himself up in his own palace. So he's going to draft your young ladies into his government service for his personal benefit, you know, so he can put on banquets and things of that nature. Verse number 14, he will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. So he will confiscate your best properties and give them to the guys that treat him best. He'll give them to the ones that are his supporters. So he'll shift properties around in Israel. Verse number 15, he will take the tenth of your grain and your vineyards and give it to his officers and to his servants. So he will tax you 10% of your annual intake. Now, that means he'll be taking the same amount that God gets, because he'll be basically substituting himself for God as king. Now, isn't this sad? Because we have a much higher rate of taxes here in the United States than 10%. And we gripe about that. They were going to gripe about this. Well, we're almost out of time, so we're going to end up coming back to this later. But listen to this next line. He will take your male servants and your female servants and the best of your young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. He'll take the tenth of your flocks and they shall be his slaves. So he's going to confiscate things all over the place for the sake of his government. And that's always the danger of centralizing power into one person.